talk about tonight. As we begin our study, we want to notice a text from Psalms chapter 103. Psalms chapter 103. In Psalms chapter 103, in verse 19, the text says, "The Lord has established His throne in the heavens, and His sovereignty rules over all." The book of Daniel is designed to help us to understand that God rules in the kingdoms of men. He rules and governs even in history and intervenes in a way that accomplishes His purpose, yet at the same time does not override the wills of men. And sometimes we use the word providence to talk about that. And Daniel becomes a classic illustration throughout the book of the providence of God. I want to wind up our study of the first chapter just by reading a few verses at the conclusion of the first chapter. There's not a lot of points that we want to make on this, but of course we might note that in this first chapter that Daniel, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, according to their Babylonian names, were to be given the king's dainties, as it were. And Randy, what did you say the New American Standard Translation?
Choice food.
But yet they declined to use those or to eat of or partake of those. And they were given a period of time to somewhat a trial to see how they would fare just eating vegetables. Well, we noticed that they did quite well, in fact, better than the other youths that had been taken captives. Now, beginning at verse 17, it says, "Now as for these four youths, God gave them knowledge and skill in all learning and wisdom. And Daniel had understanding in all visions and dreams. And at the end of the days which the king had appointed for bringing them in, the prince of the eunuchs brought them before Nebuchadnezzar. And the king communed with them, and among them all was found none like Daniel, Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah. Therefore stood they before the king. And in every matter of wisdom and understanding concerning which the king inquired of them, he found them 10 times better than all the magicians and enchanters that were in all his realm. And Daniel continued even unto the first year of King Cyrus." We simply want to notice that as Daniel, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, or Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah, expressed their faith and their confidence in the things that God had said, God blessed them as they were well favored, even 10 times. And I don't believe necessarily the 10 is there to show us the gravity of their improvement at exactly 10 times. But they were much better than those who had been taken captives with them. And so they fared better than them all. Now, in the last verse, verse 21, we are going to comment more on that later as we get a little further down in our study. But it says that Daniel continued even unto the first year of King Cyrus. Simply to note that Daniel's service in the king's house transcended the change of dominion from Babylonian dominion to the period of the Medes and the Persians under the reign of King Cyrus. Now, beginning in the second chapter, any questions or comments just here? Yes. Daniel, I'm sorry. The book of Daniel. Chapter 1, and we're starting chapter 2. That's a good question. Daniel, chapter 1 and chapter 2 is where we are. In Daniel chapter 2, just to kind of introduce our study, we want to notice in verse 21, Daniel chapter 2, verse 21, it says, "And he changeth the times and the seasons. He removeth kings and setteth up kings. He giveth wisdom unto the wise and knowledge to them that have understanding." In the reading of these verses, again, we see impressed upon our minds the sovereign rule of God to rule in the kingdoms of men. But as we begin the first verse of chapter 2, we want to notice on this chart that sometimes we have to reconcile time frames. In the second chapter, the first verse, it says, "And in the second year of the reign of Nebuchadnezzar, Nebuchadnezzar dreamed dreams in the second year of the reign of Nebuchadnezzar." But if you go back to the first chapter and notice in the first verse, it says, "In the third year of the reign of Jehoiakim, king of Judah, came Nebuchadnezzar, king of Babylon, into Jerusalem to besiege it." When we begin to try to reconcile the time frames, we see that actually we're dealing with two different systems of keeping time. Sometimes when we try to reconcile time frames in the New Testament, we try to arrange whether we're keeping time by the Jewish system of timekeeping or the Roman system of timekeeping. And sometimes there are studies that demand that we reconcile things by one or the other. And as we examine this, the first year or the second year or the third year or the fourth year, we see that they're offset just a little bit by the Babylonian system of timekeeping and the Palestinian system of timekeeping. The Babylonians counted any portion of the first year that a man had been appointed, and then started counting the full year with the first full year that he served. So the first year of the reign of a certain man would be the first full year that he served. But yet the Palestinian system of keeping time would count a portion of the year and call that the first year. And so we reconcile these two from Daniel chapter 2 and Daniel chapter 1. The second year, according to the Babylonian system, would be the third year according to the Palestinian system. So we really don't have what some scholars have tried to emphasize as a conflict. It is reconcilable. Go ahead. I don't know, it's a close draw there. That's right.
Okay.
That's right.
Counted as from the start of the year, their year to the end of their year, not...
Yeah, just as we...
The length of the year, but the actual calendar.
That's my understanding.
Okay.
They would start with this. In other words, it amounts to whether you start counting at zero or one.
Okay.
Does that make it simpler? Mm-hmm. Yeah. Randy and then John.
I was just going to say, I didn't notice a discrepancy anyway, because one is talking about the reign of Nebuchadnezzar, the other is talking about the reign of Jehoiakim.
True. There ought not be a discrepancy. But when you count down in the reign of Jehoiakim, you're dealing with the year of ascension of Nebuchadnezzar, as I recall. I may be incorrect on that. That's easy for me to get confused on when we start doing that. John?
So according to the Palestinians, if I became king in November, this would be my second year.
Yeah.
The Babylonians, this would be my first.
I think that's right. Just a tidbit of information, if you're reading some commentary and they say that there's a contradiction in the text, you can reconcile that. Okay? It's not something I want to spend a lot of time on, because I think we're all together on that. In the first verse of chapter 2, moving on, it says that Nebuchadnezzar dreamed dreams, and his spirit was troubled, and his sleep went from him. Then the king commanded to call the magicians and the enchanters and the sorcerers and the Chaldeans to tell the king his dreams. Nebuchadnezzar is troubled. He has a dream, and he calls in all these fellows. Now, we might look at these terms and say, what's the difference, 6 1, half a dozen the other? We're just talking about men who believe that they were some special characters that could explain dreams, and basically that's right. Sorcerers adhered to some form of witchcraft. The Chaldeans, they were a special class of wise men. Some have suggested that perhaps they were among the Babylonian priesthood. I'm not certain about that, and I'm not sure that anyone I've read after was absolutely certain about that, but indicated that they were some kind of special class of wise men. Soothsayers, they practiced the magical arts. Enchanters, most of what I could find on enchanters meant that they were conjurers. Now, you can take that and run with it if you want to, but the word is used only here. In Daniel chapter 2. And then wise men, all the wise men. That was the category that included even Daniel, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, as they were later called in as wise men to try to explain the things, or Daniel in particular, to explain the things that Nebuchadnezzar had dreamed. An interesting point just here as we look into the third verse. The king said unto them, I have dreamed a dream, and my spirit is troubled to know the dream. Now, question. Did Nebuchadnezzar know what he had dreamed? Did he know what he had dreamed? You'll notice in verse 5 it says, the thing is gone from me. And then you'll notice again at verse 8, because ye see the thing is gone from me. But if you'll notice in verse 9, the latter part of the verse, it says, and I shall know that ye can show me the interpretation thereof. Well, why is he asking them to explain the dream if he doesn't know what the dream was?
I think your American Standard might read differently than the New American.
All right, I'm sure it probably does.
Because it doesn't even hint that he doesn't know what his dream is.
All right, I don't believe that it hints in the American Standard that he doesn't know what his dream is. I think verse 9 makes it clear that he does know what his dream was. It's a test to these wise men to see if they can indeed interpret the dream by telling him what he had dreamed.
Verse 8 says, "The king answered and said, I know for certain that you are bargaining for time, inasmuch as you have seen that the command for me is firm."
Right. Well, the command was, tell me the dream. And they don't know what it was. They can't explain it. They can't tell him the dream nor the interpretation. And they are bargaining for time by saying, tell us the dream, and then we'll explain the interpretation thereof. That's the context. Carolyn?
Did yours read, the dream is gone from me?
In verse 5 and in verse 8, it does, yes.
Okay. That almost does sound like he's, like, you know, you wake up and you can't remember this dream and then you see later in the day or something. But, I mean, that's pretty frequent to forget a dream. But you don't,
that was not the case here. He has not forgotten the dream. He knows what he dreamed. It's a test to them to see if indeed they can interpret the dream by telling him what he dreamed without him divulging that.
I was just going to say in verse 5, it says, "The king answered and said to the Chaldeans, the command for me is firm. If you do not make known to me the dream, that's interpretation, you will be torn limb from limb and your houses will be made of rubbish."
Well, that's right, but we haven't gotten to that yet, so hold that thought. We're just talking about the dream is gone from me. What he's commanded of them is to explain it. I'm just asking the question, did he know what he had dreamed? I believe he did. Well, it doesn't say that. Let me read the text. Let me just read the text because it's different from your translation, okay? I'm going to read the entirety now, verse 5. It says, "The king answered and said to the Chaldeans, the thing is gone from me. If ye make not known unto me the dream and the interpretation thereof, ye shall be cut in pieces, and your houses shall be made a dunghill." A lot in that verse we want to talk about. But the point I'm emphasizing is, did the king know what he dreamed or not? He did know what he dreamed. Okay, the wording of the translation is not the point of controversy. The point of controversy is whether or not the king knew what he dreamed. I believe he did. He knew what he dreamed. This was a test to these wise men to see if they could explain the dream to him. We've got David, and then we got Dale. David?
I was just going to say, yeah, it's like, well, if you can tell me what I dreamed, then you might be able to interpret it.
Yeah, he's testing their qualifications. Yeah. If you can't tell me the dream, then you're not the wise man you pretend to be, I think is the point that is made.
It says he's troubled by the dream, so doesn't that mean that he knows what the dream is? He's troubled because he doesn't know what it means.
That's right. That's exactly right. He's troubled. He dreamed this, and he knows what he dreamed, but he wants somebody to explain it to him. John, and then Al, and then David.
So the wording is, the command for me is firm, or this thing has gone from me. I think they're the same. This thing meaning the command is gone from me.
Oh,
if you look at the Greek, it's the word is firm, so I think it's just, I prefer
the command. The command is gone from me with the command.
Yeah.
It's the command.
Yeah. Okay, gotcha.
You're going to do what I say.
Yeah, they were. Yeah.
Plus, he wouldn't be able to say whether they were. I mean, they could make up anything if he'd forgotten the dream. They could say anything at all.
Yeah. Al, and then David.
No, I don't really think that he really remembered.
You don't think he remembered?
I don't think he really did. How else could you be able to read it? I say that. As you read this further, when Daniel interpreted the dream, feelings about how he felt about Daniel to really reveal this thing to me.
Well, it was quite a thing. No, he doesn't know the interpretation. Daniel impresses him that he can not only tell him what his dream was, but he can also tell him the interpretation of it. But the thing that we're looking at here, I think, is significant. These wise men couldn't do either. They couldn't even take a step in that direction. They're bargaining for time. Give us some more time, more time. Sure. Yeah, I believe he did know it all the time. Yeah. Yeah.
I know you're kidding me. You come up and tell me.
Yeah.
He just wanted to bring out and let them know, I know this.
Yeah. All right. David and then John. We're in Daniel 2, by the way.
You want to know who's real.
Yeah.
He's at a point in his life where he wants at least some amount of truth or realness in it.
Yeah. Well, that's right. John?
So the Chaldeans and the wise men and all, they're bargaining for time because he's going to kill them. And I really think they got the impression that he did not remember exactly what his dream was. They knew exactly what the politicians and you will live a long life and be happy.
Well, sure.
Forever.
Yeah, yeah. Who was it, Jehoshaphat or Ahab? That was it. You or somebody was talking about Sunday morning that Ahab had all these prophets, but they'd tell him what he wanted to hear. But poor old Micaiah over there wouldn't say what he wanted to hear, and Jehoshaphat wanted to know if there's one more prophet. Well, they have certainly, they've been in training for a while. Yeah. Well, that's a possibility, I suppose. But he has this dream that's disturbing to him. And he wants to know what it means. Now, if you can tell me what the dream is, I'll consider your qualifications to interpret it. But if you can't even tell me what the dream is, and you're supposed to be among the wise men, that's a certain discredit to your ability to interpret the dream.
Sounds like he doesn't quite trust all of them anyway.
Would you? Well, again, would you? I mean, we're talking about magicians, enchanters, sorcerers, and the Chaldeans, the elite. Yeah.
Maybe you didn't want to tell them the dream and have their interpretation. You wanted the real interpretation of the dream.
That's right.
The person that can know that is who knows what the dream was.
That's right. That's exactly the point.
The king's actually being pretty
shrewd. Sure you could.
Tell me that's what it means.
Yeah.
You have no qualifications if you can't even tell me what it was.
That's
how
right.
How possibly interpret it if you can't tell me what it was? So he's actually being pretty clever here.
I think so. Yes, I think so. Well, let's notice, if you will, at verse 4, I'm going to throw out another question that we can hammer around for a little bit. In verse 4, it says, "Then spake the Chaldeans to the king in the Syrian language," or in Aramaic. Why do they now speak in Aramaic? I mean, there's a whole lot right here. It's not just a verse or two, but from here on through chapter 7, verse 28 is in Aramaic. Why? David?
They're dealing with the Aramaic, the people that speak Aramaic.
All right. Most of the Hebrews, of course, this time spoke Aramaic as well.
That was the language that was used throughout there.
So all right.
The astrologer would be speaking it. It was the educated language of the time. So.
All right. All right.
What was Daniel?
Daniel was Hebrew.
But he had been that 3-year service. He had to learn the language.
He had to learn the language. He did. That was a part of it. Terry, Peggy, and... Okay, Peggy and Randy. That would be you. I knew that. That was a test, wasn't it?
Peggy. Actually, a note that I have for the fourth verse here refers to Aramaic as the original language of Daniel.
I don't know. I might question that. Hebrew would be the native tongue of Daniel, I would think.
But even back to the dead sea scrolls, from here to chapter 7:28, that was in Aramaic in the Dead Sea Scrolls also.
Yeah.
And of course, there's the argument, the book is a false because it wasn't written.
Yeah.
160 B.C., because there's also three Greek words in there.
Yeah.
That they said, the Greeks weren't even around. But that's a falsehood too, because the Greeks had been in over in Assyria back in 722 BC.
Right.
And stuff. So, and you know, the words that they were in Greek, I think, were about musical instruments or something, which they govern just about everybody's language. You'll see a lot of those same words in everybody's language. So that wasn't hard for three Greek words.
No. But when you boil all that down, draw the line, tally it all up, all we can do is speculate.
Yeah. Yeah.
That's all we can do. Randy?
That's what the note says.
Yeah.
I was going to say that I've got a marginal reference here that says, beginning at verse 4, the text is in Aramaic from here through chapter 7.
That is correct.
So Daniel wrote in Aramaic.
That is correct. And of course, as been pointed out, he had to learn the language. This was a part of his training. He had to learn the language. All right. Any other questions or comments? Okay. Let's look then at verse 4 continuing. O king, live forever. Tell thy servants the dream, and we will show the interpretation. And the king answered and said to the Chaldeans, the thing is gone from me, if ye make not known unto me the dream and the interpretation thereof. Ye shall be cut in pieces, and your houses shall be made a dunghill. There are consequences if these wise men can't explain the dream, severe consequences to them and to their houses. In verse 6, but if ye show the dream and the interpretation thereof, ye shall receive of me gifts and rewards and great honor. Therefore show me the dream and the interpretation. And they answered the second time and said, let the king tell his servants the dream, and we will show the interpretation. And the king answered and said, I know of a certainty that ye would gain time, because ye see the thing is gone from me. But if ye make not known unto me the dream, there is but one law for you. For ye have prepared lying and corrupt words to speak before me till the time be changed. Therefore tell me the dream, and I shall know that ye can show me the interpretation thereof. Now, Carolyn, you brought up an interesting point about him trusting these folks. Look at what he says to them. Can he trust them? Pardon me? No, it doesn't look like it. He says, for ye have prepared lying and corrupt words to speak before me. How did he know that? Well, they probably do it all the time. Look at who they are, Terry. Which question now?
One you just asked.
All right, go ahead.
One, that they had already prepared what they were going to say, because if they did not have to tell the king what the dream was, okay, there's apparently ancient Babylonian omen that applies here.
Oh, okay.
And that is that if a man cannot remember the dream he saw, then it means that his personal God is angry with him.
No, nah, I've not run across that. That's interesting.
They could have already been prepared to say, well, the dream is this, that the name of their principal god was N-E-B-O, or N-A-B-O?
N-E, I believe.
N-E-B-O is angry with you. And they could have embellished on that.
Mm-hmm. That's a possibility. That is a possibility. And the king no doubt knew that.
And the king no doubt knew about this Babylonian saying. Mm-hmm.
At least that's a possibility. Mm-hmm. And but the point is, he couldn't trust them to tell him the truth. And if they could tell him what the dream was, then they could explain the interpretation. He might have some reason to believe them.
That's the conclusion we can come to from verse 9, is that asking to explain what the dream was before the interpretation is kind of like a filter.
Mm-hmm. Kind of like giving a fellow a test, isn't it?
You filter everybody out who can't tell you what the dream was, And if somebody can tell you what the dream was, then there's a good chance they're going to be able to tell you what it means, too.
That's right. That's right. Joey and then Carolyn.
I'm not sure if you addressed this or not. If so, I missed it. But it's hard for me to understand why we would have such a radically different interpretation on this phrase when you say the thing has gone from me. And my translation, King James here, says my decision is firm. The two translations seem unrelated. So could you maybe explain that?
I haven't got the slightest idea.
I think what it is, it's he says the thing has gone from me. In other words, the command has gone out from me.
Well, I'm not sure. The reading of the American Standard doesn't read that way.
In that same spot, the New King James says my decision is firm.
Yeah.
It's kind of strange to me. It sounds so different from your translation.
Yeah, the American Standard doesn't sound that way. In verse 8 in particular, it says, "The king answered and said, I know of a certainty that you would gain time, because ye see the thing is gone from me." Now, what is the thing? It says the word is gone forth from me. Perhaps it is talking about the command. I don't know. I don't know. I don't know how to explain that, Joey. All I know is that it could be seen in both lights and without doing any violence to the text. Granted, he had given an edict that if you don't explain the dream and the interpretation, then you're going to die. That's true. But the dream, whether he tries to say, I can't remember what it was, the demand is still, you've got to tell me the dream or I won't believe anything you say.
I wonder if Richard Litt has an interlinear available there.
Well, he probably does. But I'm going to leave that to you to work out with him after class. Okay? Yeah, you've got PC Study Bible there, so it'll tell you. All right. I didn't realize that was so important to our discussion.
Therefore, tell me the dream that I may know that you can declare to me its interpretation. He's got to know what the dream is because that's his personal confirmation.
Oh, that's my point. I believe he knows the dream. Yeah, he knows what he dreamed. Could very well be. I wouldn't debate it for a second. John and John.
Question on verse 9 as far as where it says, for you to hear these, to speak lying and corrupt words before me. King James says, till the time has changed. It also says it could mean until the situation has changed. Is that referring to either A, they're saying, the king saying, you're hoping that I'm going to calm down and not kill everybody, or is it going back towards the political side of it where these people were prepared to say whatever they wanted to the king of the times, and then when he gets killed or dethroned and pushed aside and a new king comes in, the situation's changed, but he knows that they've been plotting against him or something, not necessarily overthrowing, but
I think
just
it's just a thought on my part. They're prepared to say anything that will keep them alive. They're trying to buy time. Whether it be to the end of his reign or till he changes his mind, it kind of becomes an irrelevant point. Yeah, they might think they've got some tidbits of information. Yeah, they're just trying to buy time, and he knows it. All right, Terry, and then back to Carolyn.
Yeah, they go so. Maybe without realizing it, they actually admit to the king that their profession, so to speak, is fraud.
Well, sure.
They say that there's no man.
That's right.
No man.
Now, that's in verse 10, and they're right about that.
They're right about that.
They're absolutely right. I saw another hand. Carolyn, and then we're going to verse 10.
In verse 3, he's talking about how he has this dream and that he's anxious, or I think you might have said it troubled his spirit. And it might be, you know, a lot of these conjurers and sorcerers and things, half of that is entertainment value. You
look
back through history, and in the court, whether we're talking about the Middle Ages or ancient times or whatever, there just wasn't that much to do. You know, days dragged on, and they would have these, you know, gestures and different things. I'm sure a lot of it was just, you know, pass the time. But he's telling them, I don't just want you to, you know, sort of pretend to know, make up something about this dream. This is a serious dream. This mm-hmm. really means something, and I've got to know what this one means. And you know, charlatans, I'm going to clear the field here of you guys. I want somebody who's actually real, because this is a serious dream. This is not just, you know, so, you know how we all have strange, crazy dreams that don't make any sense. This one troubled him so much, he had to get somebody who really knew what they were talking about.
Well, Daniel tells him at verse 27, I believe it is, that God has made something known to him in this dream. So yes, this wasn't just the average run-of-the-mill dream. This was a very peculiar dream in a lot of ways. All right, David?
I think King set a pretty good standard. Don't fool with me.
Well,
you know, today if we had that standard.
Perhaps so. We're not going there, David. Verse 10. The Chaldeans answered before the king and said, "There is not a man upon the earth that can show the king's matter, for as much as no king, lord, or ruler hath asked such a thing of any magician or enchanter or Chaldean. And it is a rare thing that the king requireth, and there is no other that can show it before the king except the gods whose dwelling is not with flesh." Now let's throw out something else. These men understand they can't do it. No man can do it. And no man can do it except the gods who dwell, whose dwelling is not with flesh. What are they saying?
They're recognizing that there is a God, a true God.
Well, there's somebody that can do this, but we can't do it.
We don't have
the answer. Yes, Al? Mine does too. They're not referring to one true and living God. None. All these gods that they were familiar with, not a one of them could do what the king requires.
I was going to say, they're referring to their gods.
They're referring to their gods, the gods that they're familiar with.
I think kind of what they're saying is, you're not going to find anyone better than us short of the gods. Please don't kill us.
All right.
When they said no king, no lord, and ruler, that's apt. They're kind of accusing him of being unfair.
Yeah. Nobody can do this. You're asking the impossible.
Yeah, you're being unfair because this is not.
All right.
And there. I heard of except in there. Except.
Verse 11.
Dwellings is without flesh.
Yeah. Nobody can do this. Nobody among us can do this. That's his point, I think. Daryl?
I thought it was a while ago. I wasn't going to say anything, but we dwelled on this. Whether you remember or not so long. I don't really think that's the important point.
It isn't. Yeah.
But I was going to say, if he was really going to be a snake, he could have just made up a dream.
There's a whole lot of conjecture in this, isn't there?
What does it mean?
Yeah. Yeah.
Well, that wasn't it.
Yeah.
The other point that always has fascinated me for years is how even you said it, and it's a habit, but we're repeating it from Scripture, how it says their gods couldn't.
We're going to talk more about their gods when Nebuchadnezzar begins to praise Daniel. So let's hold on that for just a little bit.
I just want to say, throughout Scripture, even with the inspiration of the Holy Spirit, men are referring to your gods are false or whatever, or can't do this, when in fact those gods are no gods at all.
That's right. Randy and then John.
I was just going to point out that passage we just read kind of reminds me of what Paul said in 1 Corinthians chapter 2.
Okay.
In verse 11. For who among men knows the thoughts of a man except the spirit of a man which is in him? Even so the thoughts of God no one knows except the spirit of God. Even the magicians and the conjurers knew that no man can tell another man what he's thinking.
Well, that's right. That's the demand.
Everybody knows that. And then Daniel took it one step further. Of course, we haven't reached that point yet. But Daniel even knows that I can't tell you what you thought, but God can tell me and I can tell you.
Mm-hmm. And that's where we're heading with this. Yeah. All right. John?
Yeah, I kind of disagree. I think it is important that he does remember the dream. If he does not, then the test is like me saying, I'm thinking of a 20-digit number, tell me what it is. And that's a test.
Yeah.
I mean, if you tell me that 20-digit number offhand, you know, maybe I'll listen to you. But I thought of a 20-digit number sometime. Give me a 20-digit number. Then you spill off something. Yeah, that sounds good.
Yeah. Okay. All right. Terry and then Dick. Yeah.
Actually, the real lesson for us here is that it's only God who can reveal the thoughts of men.
And that's what Daniel says when we get down to the 25th, 26th verses. All right, Dick?
You can see it's a very important thing as we go on in the text, what it results in.
That's right. Let's go on in the text. In verse 12. For this cause the king was angry and very furious and commanded to destroy all the wise men of Babylon. So the decree went forth and the wise men were to be slain and they sought Daniel and his companions to be slain. Daniel and his companions, these young captives, are included as among the wise men and their lives are threatened as well. So Daniel steps to the front. He returned answer with counsel, verse 14, and prudence to Arioch, the captain of the king's guard, who was gone forth to slay the wise men of Babylon. And he answered and said to Arioch, the king's captain, wherefore is the decree so urgent from the king? And Arioch made the thing known to Daniel. And Daniel went in and desired of the king that he would appoint him a time, and he would show the king the interpretation. Daniel is simply wanting an appointment. You set me an appointment and I'll tell you. I'll tell you the dream and I'll tell you what it means. Now, you can't imply that Daniel's going to take the interpretation before the king without telling the king the dream. Daniel knows the dream, or he's about to, and he's going to tell him the dream, and he's going to explain to him what it means. He's asked Arioch, the captain, why is this thing so urgent? Why has he demanded the meaning of the dream with the threat of life? Why is it so urgent? And Arioch explains it to him. Now, no doubt he explains the king has had a dream that's troublesome to him and he wants to know the meaning of it, etc., etc., etc. Daniel says, I'll step to the plate, give me an appointment, and I'll explain to him the interpretation of the dream. Now, look, if you will, at verse 17. It says, then Daniel went to his house and made the thing known to Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah, his companions, that they would desire mercies of the God of heaven concerning this secret, that Daniel and his companions should not perish with the rest of the wise men of Babylon. What is it that Daniel encourages them to do when they would desire mercies of the God of heaven concerning this?
Verse 18 is very significant. God doesn't just unsolicited, if you will, reveal this. They seek the help of God. They apparently approach God in prayer asking for help regarding this matter. And it reminds me of the principle we read about that the prayer of a righteous man availeth much. They actually sought, you know, mercies from God, help us in this matter, reveal this to us, and God responded. But they had to ask. It just wasn't automatic.
It's interesting, too. They go to God in prayer and ask for his help.
Right.
The other wise men, they go to the astrology books, to the stars, and all that stuff to get their answers, or supposed to get their answers.
All right, that's right. Now, you've pointed out an interesting observation, Joey. They go to God, as David has. They want to go to God in prayer regarding this very important occasion. In Nehemiah, the first and the second chapters, we're reading of a time frame very similar to what we're talking about during the reign of King Cyrus, or Xerxes, after Cyrus. And so Nehemiah is cupbearer to the king. He comes in before the king, and the king sees that Nehemiah is very unhappy about something. He wants to know, what are you unhappy about? Your countenance is sad. Nehemiah is shaken by that. Wouldn't you be? If the highest and mightiest power in the world asked you, Joey, what's wrong with you? And then Nehemiah tells him that the house or the place of my father's sepulchers lies in ruins. All right, then the king says, what can I do about it? And Nehemiah prays. But formerly we've seen that Nehemiah prayed that he might find favor before this man. Now, when King Xerxes says, what can I do to help? Has the prayer of Nehemiah been answered? And then when Nehemiah prays once again, and he tells the king what he can do to help, send me. And then the king says, not only will I send you, but what do you need? Well, I need letters of the forest of Lebanon to get the lumber to build the gates and the walls around the city. And he gives him these letters to have free passage, to give him the materials that are necessary to rebuild the walls around the city of Jerusalem. Do we see the prayers of a righteous man avails much in the case of Nehemiah? And that's what we're seeing in the case of these young captives.
As far as the necessity of prayer, I'm also reminded of the passage that says, "You have not because you ask not."
All right. That's true. Now you're going to tell me where that is.
It's somewhere in the New Testament.
Yeah, I figured that. David and then Bruce.
We also see that the prayer is asked in confidence. You know, because Daniel's already told the king he's going to dream. He's asked in confidence, and they're asked in total dependency. If he doesn't, he's going to die. He'll accept that death.
All right, that's right. He knows that God's going to answer the prayer because he's going to explain the interpretation. Daniel says, "I'm going to tell you the interpretation." That's what Daniel said. Now, he can't tell him the interpretation without telling him first what the dream was. So Daniel's going to fill the bill.
When he's saying, when it says that he went to the house and made the thing known to Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, or Massive, is that everything, the dream, the interpretation?
No, I think he's explaining to Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, here's the deal. Here's what the king demands. And we're going to do that. We're going to tell him what it is that he dreamed and what the dream means. Yeah. All right.
I'm going to say that this must be, the thing known thing must be a form of Aramaic speech that is used frequently, because in each instance where, in this chapter so far, where it talks about the thing, it's the same Aramaic word. And so He's just using it here as a general word to describe something. It's not referring to the thing. In other words, the dream. Right. It's referring to things in general. So when he says here, Daniel went to his house and made the thing known to them that they would desire, he says what he made known to them was that they needed to pray.
Well, that works. That's where you start, isn't it?
Yep.
Okay. Any other comment or question before we go on? Carolyn?
Earlier, as we were talking about the how he tells his supposed wise men, he's like, "Come on, tell me now. I know you've been talking to each other and making some stuff up. Tell me right now. Quit stalling." But yet, Daniel is apparently given time to leave and prepare and come back.
Mm-hmm. Well, now keep in mind, Daniel's not before the king. Daniel's before the captain.
True.
And so what he wants is to appear before the king. So he's given time to leave and then come back. Isn't that correct?
Mm-hmm.
That's what I thought. Okay. John?
In 16 it says, well, after he talks to Arioch, it says, "So Daniel went in and requested of the king."
Okay. And desired of the king.
Yeah, but just because you request to see the king don't mean you're talking
to
him.
No. No. Arioch is the go-between. I don't think that Daniel has the opportunity just to appear before the king. He wants an appointed time.
Well, it says, okay, so maybe something else that I don't understand.
All right.
Arioch goes out to slay all the wise men. He runs into David. Now he's out, or Daniel, and he's out there with the intent of killing David.
Mm-hmm.
But Daniel now talks to him and says, you know, what's going on? So Arioch informs him. And it says, Daniel went in and requested of the king that he would give him time in order that he might declare the interpretation of the king in 16. So, what would stop Arioch from killing Daniel right there on the spot, if that is his order, short of him going at least to the king, to the king's office, someone who represents the king higher, who Arioch is the king or the chief of the bodyguards? Someone who would say, yeah, okay, give him time, don't kill him.
I don't know why Arioch would be so anxious to carry out that command to begin with, but that's another thought. It very well may be that Arioch's looking for some kind of an out on this, where he don't have to kill all these men. If he can answer the question that the king has asked, then why kill anybody? Here's a possibility to explain the dream to the king, and that's what's troubling him. He's going to tell you what you want to know.
Well, maybe the simple answer is the providence of God is keeping Daniel alive here.
Now, there's a thought to go figure. God rules in the kingdoms of men. Let's not forget the theme of this book.
That's true, but short of him, I guess short of him going, and it doesn't, this part I don't really think matters, but short of him going to the king and getting a reprieve from the king to get some time. Okay, so you come to me and say, well, he's going to tell you what it means. Well, what I'm going to say is, no, you idiot, he's just stalling from time.
Let me interrupt you, if I may, and just make a suggestion. What we're reading is a narrative. And we don't need to read more into the narrative than what's there. All we know is what it says, that Daniel has made a request to explain this thing to the king. That's all we know. He makes this request evidently to the man who's come to kill him. Why he's given opportunity, I don't know. The text just says that he was. And that's all that we need to make of it. It's a narrative to get us to some more important things, and that is the explanation of the dream. And that's my thoughts on the thing. We can kind of get bogged down on some of these details and miss the forest for the trees.
Daniel was a captive. He wasn't considered like a wise man.
He and these young men had been prepared for 3 years to be numbered among the wise men. So yes, they were captives who were considered wise men. They had been trained to be so. They had had to learn the language, the customs, and the rules, and so forth and so on, that characterized the Babylonian Empire. Yes?
Well, I haven't read it, I didn't understand. They are not on the kill of the wise men. Yeah, you said 3 years, but it doesn't say that they served the 3 years because they were not even notified. They had to go and tell them that this was going to happen. Why would they, if they knew, if they was a part, they would have known along with the wise men.
Well, let's notice if you would, beginning at verse 13. It says, so the decree went forth, and the wise men were to be slain, and they sought Daniel and his companions to be slain. What does that say about Daniel and his companions? They're lumped in the same boat with the others who are wise men. Evidently. Yeah. I think so. Now let's drop down, if you will, to verse number 19. It says, then was the secret revealed unto Daniel in a vision of the night. Then Daniel blessed the God of heaven. Daniel answered and said, blessed be the name of God forever and forever, or ever and ever, for wisdom and might are His. And He changeth the times and the seasons. He removeth kings. He setteth up kings. He giveth wisdom unto the wise, and knowledge to them that have understanding. He revealeth the deep and secret things. He knoweth what is in the darkness, and the light dwelleth with Him. I thank Thee and praise Thee, O Thou God of my fathers, who hast given me wisdom and might, and hast now made known unto me what we desired of Thee. For Thou hast made known unto us the king's matter. Now let's pause. Now here's where we want to do some serious thinking. Our thinking has to do with what Daniel knows and the source of it. Doesn't have to do with a whole lot of speculation. God has made some things known to Daniel. And Daniel is thankful to God for the ability to explain the dream. This is made known unto Daniel in a vision. Now visions, the word vision or visions occurs about 32 times in the book of Daniel. 22 times in the singular, 10 times in the plural. And Daniel, you got me saying that now, Daniel is giving thanks and praise to God for the things that are made known by God. Now that's where we want to begin, well, in our next study, Terry. You're going to be here next Wednesday, okay? If you would, talk about that some. The things that Daniel is known or knows and the thanks that he gives to God for those things, beginning in these verses right here, verse 19. Please. You can talk about that some before some other things. Or hold it till I get back. I want to talk about that, beginning at verse 19. You can talk about whatever you'd like, but I want to talk about verse 19 and following, because that's in the text and that's an important thought we don't need to leave hanging, okay?